Gordon Call was right when he made his famous stand. Heaven knows there was a man who fought the righteous fight till the wrong arm of the law gunned him down in Arkansas. He would not pay one dime of tribute to the IRS, and for his disobedience they fanned his fiery death. And now all is fair in love and war. Christian blood has been shed before, and though these tents of flesh may fail, the gates of hell shall never prevail. Because he gave his life for me, I shall not fear adversity, and we shall all meet at heaven's door. 'Cause all is fair in love and war. PM on a North Dakota road, February '83, that's when the war began, where two federal marshals died for the sake of tyranny. They both would underestimate the courage of one man who only shot in self-defense to save his promised land. Because shall not fear adversity, and we shall all meet at heaven's door. 'Cause all is fair in love and war. When all was said and done, and the verdicts handed down, someone had to take the fall, and it was Gordon's son who was wounded in the fray. Please won't you pray for your recall, who now must waste his life away inside some stinking jail. Please pray the Lord might set him free. Through faith we shall prevail. They say all is fair in love and Christian blood has been shed before, and though these tents of flesh may fail, the gates of hell shall never prevail. Because he gave his life for me, I shall not fear adversity, and we shall all meet at heaven's door. 'Cause all is fair in love and war.
Playing this for a reason. This is Terrible Tommy in the bunker here in Warsaw, Indiana, P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 465-81. That's where you send your donations for this show. I started to do a video and explain more of what I'm going to tell you today yesterday, and I got a little screwed up. I don't know. I don't think I got much of that out because I took two or three tries at the video, and it's obvious now, and it's explained to me by one of our British friends, Englander friends, that we need a video controller on there to make a big video smaller. And so we're going to put that video thing aside until we get that figured out. So anyhow, this was Carl Klang, and he did a lot of music. And it was good music, but it had a Christian basis to it, and that's not all that's wrong with it. Of which the right wing, of course, is full of people who say they're Christians. I don't necessarily think that they are very Christian if you look at it in the strictest way. You know what I mean. Gordon Call was a great guy, fine guy, but he was old school, and he fell for the same thing that a whole lot of other right-wingers fell for in the early days, and that was to confront the government head-on, which no guerrilla outfit or revolutionary group that's got really the thing figured out is going to do. You do not confront them. You know, it's like these blacks pulling a gun on the sidewalk and there's a cop. You know what the end of that's going to be. It's going to end badly. So Gordon Call was one of, geez, must have been a dozen people during that time. It came out of the tax rebellion, and I was involved in that tax rebellion for a while. In fact, that's one of the reasons they kicked me out of the John, or wanted to kick me out of the John Birch Society, is because they didn't want anybody that was in the tax rebellion. Well, I went out with guys and we surrounded small businesses and so forth that they were trying to sell and get the money for the IRS. And we'd show up 50 strong, surround the business, and sing patriotic songs to the point where the sheriff had to just give up and go home. Usually, eventually, they got the property. But at least there was resistance going on. And I remember traveling to Michigan at one point where there was a young Vietnam veteran that had a pizza parlor the IRS was trying to take, and we were all ready to do whatever had to be done. And I could have been right there in the middle of it, but they made the deal. It didn't happen. I got there late anyhow and flew in. But here all of us guys are, you know, we meant well, but we were ready to give our lives and go to prison forever. And it wouldn't have made a bit of difference. Wouldn't have made a bit of difference. Then, like I was trying to say yesterday, then the next thing, or just before that, was the Minutemen. And I was never a member of the Minutemen, but I knew Minutemen. I knew Minutemen who were patrolling the outer perimeter of Watts during the Watts riots to make sure those Darky boys didn't get into the white neighborhoods and start shooting up white neighborhoods. That was going on at one time. That was about 64, I think. And let me see, where was I? Well, anyhow, oh yeah. And of course, that was during the time when Robert Depew was running around. And he had a lot of power there for a while. He had a small chemical company or medicine company in Norborn, Missouri. He had quite a bit of money. And they were stockpiling weapons like you wouldn't believe. They were burying tons of weapons all over the Southern California desert. Maybe Northern California woods, I don't know. But anyhow, they've been finding that stuff for years. People would go out there hiking and so forth, and they'd kick over grenades and boxes of ammo and everything, all kinds of automatic weapons, I guess. I know that now that they're passed away, it doesn't hurt to say that Reverend Comparé from San Diego and Colonel William P. Cale, he was heavy into it, and later on started a group called the Committee of the States, which he wanted me to be a captain in it, and I said, no way, I'm not joining any group at this point. And also, Reverend Butler was involved at that time, and I guess they knew where everything was buried. They never told me. But that was actually before, a little while before I came on the scene anyhow. But we had all these guys that were committed that the Russians were coming. And the way the military-industrial complex talked it up, you know, it wouldn't be too hard to believe that's true. So there were a lot of people making some brash moves, like a lot of these guys were selling their properties in L.A. and moving up in the hills and mountains. I remember going up to see one of these guys. I forget why, but I went to see one of these guys, and he was 50s. He's in his 50s or 60s at least. And I guess he stayed up there, and the Russians didn't come, and he just died. A lot of guys like that that went back up in the hills because they feared the Russian invasion, but the Russian invasion didn't happen. Then during that period of time, there was also the rumors of a Soviet invasion over the North Pole through Canada. And there was also rumors of an invasion from Mexico by the Chinese. And the Chinese were training down there. One congressman Utt, fell into the trap and believed it. And he lost his congressional seat because of it. And then there was a wild man called Peter Beter. Now, don't laugh. I know you're laughing. And he was giving speeches all over the country that the Russians had buried or sunk atomic bombs in the bays around the country, in New York Harbor and all that stuff, and everywhere where there was a bay like that or a harbor, and a big one, they had sunk atomic bombs into it. So they had people all excited for a while, too. So you got to understand, this is the period of time when I was just getting involved, and it was, and of course, the John Birch Society, I learned a lot from the John Birch Society, a lot of the books, but eventually I had to get out of it because they said that if you're out here in a KKK or anything like that, or a National Socialist or anything, really wanting to fight for white people, that you're doing the communist work. That was Robert Welch, the leader of the Birch Society's position. If you weren't totally concentrating on the communist menace, then you were helping the communists. So anybody that was off into the hinterlands working for the white race was persona non grata. And in the John Birch Society, if you had anybody in your chapters that talked about race or the Jews, you're supposed to have to kick them out, even though a hell of a lot of those chapters were full of those kind of people. So this was all the turmoil going on at the time, and then you had the Goldwater election. That was a big deal back then. Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And boy, oh boy, that got the left-wingers upset. So I'm trying to give you a little background to the problem here. Now and every so often, now in the 80s, we had the... Colonel Gale, he had his Committee of the States, which was similar to the militias and so forth like that. Incidentally, when he was grabbed and thrown, he was a very sick man, taken out of his house in the middle of the night and thrown into a cold cell into jail. He was half dead anyhow. Which they like to get you like that so you'll die. Well, anyhow, I called his wife and said, can I come up there and bring some men with me up into Fresno, I believe it was. She said, no. But none of those Committee of the States soldiers showed up, even though their leader had been dragged out in the middle of the night in his pajamas, sick as hell, and probably dying at the time. So you, and that reminds me of Francis Gillings. He was a guy who was into this kind of stuff too. Similar to this Oath Keeper thing. These are all similar to the Oath Keeper thing. And Francis bought himself some land up in the mountains, and he was putting together a mobile home park headquarters, where all these right-wing conservative types, radicals, could move to and all be together. And I said, first of all, that ain't going to work because they fight like cats and dogs. If you had been in the right wing very long, you'd know what I mean. They'd rather fight than switch. I think they fight each other more than they fight their alleged enemy. Francis came down to see me one time, just after he was getting this thing off the ground, and we went to the restaurant and had a cup of coffee, and he told me what he was doing. I said, Francis, I advise you not to do it. And he says, why? I said, well, Francis, I know you. You're a stand-up guy, and you'll stand up to the government no problem and shoot it out with them. I know you will, because I know you. But you're, millions of American white people are not like that. And you're going to be up there in your mobile home park or whatever it is, and in the early morning, cold, damp, fog on the laying across the ground, and you're going to hear a interesting noise outside. Clang, 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 clang. And you're going to jump out of bed, put on your camis, grab your gun, and away you go out there and look down the road, and here comes a couple of tanks, a couple of half-tracks, and about 100 well-armed troops walking beside him. So you know what's going to happen. Now, I know what will happen. You will fight it out. You will shoot it out. And you will die. But you'll turn around and look behind you for all these conservative right-wingers to be back behind you. And they're not going to be there. They're not going to be there. Well, fortunately, it never happened. These people, these right-wing conservatives, once they got several people in there living there, they started fighting, like I said, like cats and dogs, and ended up suing each other and everything else because somehow they owned part of the plot that their trailer was on. And so Francis had to give up in disgust. Well, I told him that was going to happen. Because having a lot of experience in the right-wing conservative struggle, you'll know that they'd rather fight than switch. Now, in the 80s, we had the militias. And, boy, they were going strong, just like this Oath Keepers. And they got pretty damn big. And then they started picking them off one by one, and the rest of them ran for cover. In fact, when the Murrah building was bombed in Oklahoma City, the next day you couldn't find a militia person anywhere. They were gone, baby. Before that, they were walking around their camis with their guns and, wow, we'll never be taken alive and all that, but after the Murrah building, the Clinton operation, they were gone. But before they were, when they were riding high, I debated some of these guys on national television. And I said, how do you think you're going to upset this federal government just having a few guys out in the woods? Well, we're there and we're all over the place. And I said, well, you know what's going to happen? What's that, Metzger? Well, some morning or maybe noon, you're going to hear a big lot of noise rumbling. Going to be a jet coming in, a fighter jet. And he's going to come in at treetop level and drop a couple of canisters of napalm on your camp, and that's the end of your guerrilla army. I have a lot of respect for what a lot of these people think they would like to do, but it won't work. They're just not in the right groove, and I keep telling them that. That's not the way to do it. That's not the way it's going to be done. You got to let Mother Nature take her course here a little bit. So, and then, of course, all the militias said, oh, that Metzger, which when I went against the war criminal Ronald Reagan, even though I was running a Klan group. All these other Klan groups said, oh, that Metzger, he's a traitor. Well, they didn't know anything about Ronald Reagan, and I did. Well, anyhow, let's see, what's next? Okay, so they disappeared just as quick as they had appeared, the militias. One thing you got to understand is that military people are not necessarily brave, and they're not necessarily smart. In fact, I was, of course, in the Army. I did 3 years. I ran across some of the dumbest people I'd ever met in the military because at certain times they recruit about anybody like they are all these niggers. Filling the Army full of niggers, you're going to go up against the Russians. Oh, man. Anyhow, let's see, where was I? Oh, yeah. That just because a guy's been in the service or even been in the front line someplace doesn't make him brave when he gets back here. After the Vietnam War, we were sure all these troops are going to come back here and join up with us and really get things going. Didn't happen. There's something about a military man in a war zone that's different when he comes back into his own area, his own region. They become pussies, most of them, not all of them, but either that or they become drug users or bank robbers or something like that. Now, if you think it's not that way up the line in the echelon, I knew at least two generals in California. One, I was in his home every once in a while, every few weeks. We'd sit there and have a cigar and a little scotch, and he was retired, four-star general, Twining. He's been gone a long time now, but he used to support the right to keep and bear arms and guns and things like that, but to get him to do anything more than that, forget it. And you know the reason? Well, at least half of the reason was the money they get in retirement. These guys like that, they don't want to lose their retirement because they know if they got involved with somebody like Tom Metzger or another crazy radical, they're going to lose their stuff, their money. And he liked to play golf. He liked to drink good scotch. He liked to smoke good, expensive Cuban cigars and the whole bit. So don't tell me that these guys are brave, most of them that are military men. And like I say, they can be very brave in a foreign country, mowing down people and fighting back and fighting off the so-called enemy. But when they come back here, most of them are pussies. And I hear all these veterans talking badly about the Oath Keepers. And most of the guys, these military guys, are bad-mouthing these people. And, in fact, if the crap hits the fan, I'm sure they'll be volunteering to go out in the woods and find them and kill them. So this is based on that article that I sent to you yesterday. Oath Keepers will say they're not racist. So did the militia, but we know that within their ranks there's, probably 25 to 50% that are racist. They just keep their mouth shut. In fact, this one, this Oath Keeper group up there in Northern California had some non-whites in it. The militias in the 80s, they recruit. In fact, one big militia leader was a nigger. They wanted to show everybody they weren't racist, so they promoted this Negro to the leadership of one of the big militia groups. The other thing that shows the ignorance of these people is that they say they're defending the Constitution. That's their primary interest, to defend the Constitution. Well, I'm sorry, guys, but that Constitution's been dead as a doornail, except being used against us white working people for 100 years. That Constitution is dead in the doornail when it comes to us. They keep it sort of alive in the sense that they use it against us, because they've got the supreme swine standing there ready to do it, you know, all those rats on the Supreme Court. They determine that. They determine what the Constitution means. So if they want it to mean one thing, they'll decide that way. If they want it to mean something else, it'll go that way. That's right. And then they got the feds have got all these federal judges, federal district courts. These are the Jesuits of the federal government, standing guard at the gates so that you rabble cannot get to the government itself. That's what they're there for. The nonsense that they're really working for the rank and file Americans, and especially white Americans, is ridiculous. So these guys show their stupidity right off by saying our main goal is to protect the Constitution. We swore an oath to the Constitution. You know, these asshole criminals in Washington, they laugh at that behind closed doors. They laugh at these. In fact, then all the radio talk shows and even the right wing gets on there making fun of them. And the guys are ready to go out and die. Go out in the woods and die against the federal government. Believe me, boys, something's going to happen, but it's not going to be done this way at all. That way is gone. It's over. There might have been a time when you had some possibility of winning something like that. But not anymore. We're living in the most well-armed police state there ever has been. The most dictatorial. But they do it with a velvet glove, you know. They don't, they're not marching down the street yet and ordering you out of your house. This reminds me of when a lot of the guys, gun rights guys, see, there used to be a bumper sticker. I'll give up my guns when they pry them out of my cold, dead hands. And I used to say, they will. And I tell these guys, and they get mad at me. I say, you know, some morning at the end of your block, there's going to be several deuce and a halfs and a few couple of half tracks down there. They're going to have a big loudspeaker on one of those units, and they're going to say, all you people on this block, you will throw your guns into the street. This is your last warning. And the first time, a few guns would come out, but not many. But then the next one would be, throw out all your guns or you're all going to be killed. And all the guns will come out. This idea of these well-armed people, I mean, you know, they're all over the place. They've got basements full of weapons, all that. They'll never fire them. There's been many right-wingers have been armed to the teeth. Boy, they'll never take my guns or take me alive. They meekly surrendered. They never fired one shot. You read in the paper all the time, at least over the period of 20, 30, 40 years that I've been around. Hardly any of them ever shot it out. In fact, to be perfectly honest, the niggers fought it out more with the cops and everybody else and the feds than white guys. Now, isn't that a sad state of affairs? So I advise, I cannot order anybody to do anything. And I can't order them not to do anything. All I can do is advise. And my advice is to stay away from anything, any group like that, any oath keepers, because they're full of informants, full of instigators, too, to try to get you to draw down on the feds and the whole bit. And eventually, there'll either be a lot of these people killed or imprisoned, or both, and they won't accomplish a goddamn thing. So play it smart. Play it smart. There's one reason I'm still walking around. It's not because I work for the government either. A lot of right-wingers say, that Metzger, he's never been in prison. He must be on the payroll of the CIA. Well, if I am, by God, they owe me a lot of money. No. But anyhow, that's the way it goes. Like that great song by Tony Bennett. I want to be around to pick up the pieces. Yeah. Or at least the younger people that are going our way, they'll be around, even if I'm not, you're not. Well, you mentioned Tony Bennett, got me all excited here because this is Freya's Day, Friday, She-Wolf Day in the bunker.
Oh, the good life, full of fun, seems to be the ideal. Yes, the good life, it makes you hide all the sadness you feel. You won't really fall in love, for you can't take the chance. So just be honest with yourself. Don't try to fake romance. Yes, the good life, to be free and explore the unknown. Just like the heartache when you learn you must face life alone. So just remember, I still want you. And in case you wonder why, well, just wake up, kiss the good life goodbye. Cause I want to be around to pick up the pieces. Somebody breaks your heart. Somebody twice as smart as I. Somebody who would swear to be true, like you used to do with me. Who would leave you to learn misery loves company. Wait and see. I want to be around to see how it does it when it breaks your heart to bits. Let's see if that puzzle really fits so fine. That's when I'll discover that revenge is sweet. As I sit there applauding from a front row seat, somebody breaks your heart just like you broke mine. When somebody breaks your heart,
that's the kind I like. I like that stuff, man. I like to sing it, too. I sing Sinatra. I sing Tony Bennett once in a while. Yeah, how about that? Now, don't laugh. One of my favorites is That's Life by Frank Sinatra. I sing that quite a bit, almost every time I go out. Well, I guess we've covered the Oath Keepers. Oh, incidentally, we shouldn't be having as much trouble from Congress anymore. You know how they're always sticking it to us? That's because they've lost their boner. Ha! 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 Pardon me. Well, let's go back to our great book, The Pessimist's Guide to History. Yeah, let's go back when Nero was persecuting the Christians. And I don't really think he was persecuting the Christians that much, unless they were causing a lot of trouble. You read Gibbon's Rise and Fall of Rome and you'll find out what the Christians were doing. They're wacko, whacked out people. In the aftermath of the great fire that destroyed Rome, Many blamed the Roman Emperor Nero for setting the fires. Nero knew well enough that the Roman citizens were cruel by their sports to blood inured. They wanted revenge, and Nero is said to have cleverly planned to blame on the Christians and to divert the Romans' attention from the tragic fire by mixing games and gaiety with spectacles of refined, atrocious cruelty. Like I say, I'm very suspect of this. Nero no doubt found Christians to be the perfect scapegoats. Doesn't that remind you of somebody else? Christianity at this time was unpopular and little understood by many in Rome. Well, that's because Mithraism was the official church of Rome, and Mithraism's still a good idea. The reason people went over to Christianity was, I've told you before, because they could confess their sins and be forgiven. Under Mithraism, if you did something terrible, you'll never be forgiven. Your family will carry that also into the future. So, to me, that seems, this idea that no matter what you do, you can confess and be forgiven sounds like a bunch of bullshit to me. Christians were rumored to have held orgies, killing small children to provide blood and body they consumed during their services. Remember that? They say that about the Jews, too. Of course, many of these so-called Christians were Jews. Furthermore, the faith welcomed what Romans considered inferior beings, women and slaves. Christians believed all religions were false, offended those who practiced them. In other words, the Christians were preaching, if you believed in another religion, you were bad and bad things should happen to you. Well, they killed millions. I mean, you know that. Christian beliefs that all other religions were false offended those who practiced them. You know, before that, you could have all kinds of religions. People got along and hardly had any trouble at all until the Christians came along. Okay, while Roman rulers who depended on absolute obedience from their subjects also felt threatened by Christian tenets. Ordering all Christians in Rome rounded up, Nero had all who confessed to their beliefs convicted on charges of setting the deadly fires and of hatred of mankind. Then came the cruel and bloody spectacles in which a vast multitude of Christians were put to death. Well, I think in this country it's going to come to the point when these Zionist Christians are so powerful that it's going to be us or them, as far as I'm concerned. That don't make me a friend of the... Boy, the right wing gets a little upset when I say stuff like this. Thus began the first mass persecution of the early Christians. You notice how the Christians are always whining that they're persecuted? They're whining all over this country. They're persecuted. And if they convert non-whites all over the world to Christianity, and then they're persecuted, or they have problems in their own countries, then they're all persecuted. Wow. I have a little problem here, I think, with my recorder. Anyhow, if some of this stuff's dropping out a little bit, it seems to me my MP3 recorder. A historian writes that various forms of mockery were added to enhance their dying agonies. Many were publicly crucified to the cheers of the Roman crowds. Well, the Romans were pagans. Others were covered with the skins of wild beasts and then set upon and mangled by dogs as thousands of approving Roman citizens watched on. Children and elderly Christians were mauled and torn to pieces by the tigers in the open theaters of the city. Nero also held chariot races in the gardens of the royal palace after twilight, illuminating the festivities with the human torches. Christians were smeared with pitch and tar and set ablaze to throw light on the races. Persecutions of the Christian, that wouldn't give much light. A body doesn't burn very easy. I mean, it takes hours in extreme heat to burn a body. And to make it as a torch to light the races? That don't sound practical. Persecutions of the Christians in the Roman Empire continued sporadically over the next centuries, often brought on by the calamity, such as an earthquake, a flood, or even a loss in battle, for which Christians were then held responsible. The Edict of Milan in 313 finally granted official sanction to Christianity within the empire, putting an end to the persecutions. Oh, yeah, the Christians. Then the Christians started persecuting back, where they killed millions of people all throughout Europe, Eastern Europe. The last great battle of the White Arians, non-Christians, against Christianity was in Lithuania. Interestingly enough, some of the most beautiful women I've ever seen, the most beautiful Arian women I've ever seen, seemed to come out of Lithuania. Well, about AD 70, the siege of Jerusalem. It was spring in Jerusalem when Titus, heir to the Roman imperial throne, arrived with an army of 80,000 men to lay siege to the city. The Chews had been in revolt against the Roman rule since 66. Well, that's about 4 years, and Titus now intended to force the city into submission. Hey, you kikes, we're coming in there, you better be cool. He had not counted the city's heavily fortified walls, however, nor on the huge number of devoted Jews from the surrounding countryside who were now inside the Jewish holy city and fiercely determined to protect it. Whoever wrote this book is obviously, well, do I have to tell you? Nevertheless, the Romans began their siege and chose Passover as the day to attack the city walls, believing that the devout Jews would not fight on that day. To their surprise, the Jews vigorously repulsed the attack, killing hundreds of soldiers and destroying many Roman battering rams. Even the women of the city took part, pouring boiling oil on the heads of their attackers. Well, I've never said that the Jews as a group were necessarily any more cowardly than any other people, to be perfectly honest. And they certainly have had some fierce warriors, that's for sure. Not to the extent that the Bible talks about, because most of that's bullshit. But the Jews were unable to break the siege as fighting continued in the following weeks. The Romans closed off all access to the city and proceeded to wear down the defenders in any way they could. In one case, Titus crucified 500 prisoners, sent still others back into the city after cutting off their hands. But the Jews continued to resist. Well, they didn't have much choice, did they? Then famine overtook the besieged cities. Starving, people are eating grass, bits of leather, anything. Gangs roamed the streets, breaking into homes in search of food, or eating horrid refuse from the streets. According to the Jew historian Josephus, no respect was paid even to the dying. The ruffians searched them in case they were concealing somewhere in their clothes or just pretending to be near death. Now, this is Jews doing this to Jews. In one horrible case, a woman killed her own baby to eat its body. Unburied corpses littered the streets. Still, the Jews would not surrender their city. Finally, the Romans dislodged Jerusalem's zealous defenders from the city's outer wall, thereby gaining entrance to the city. But the Jews refused to surrender and took up new positions behind the massive walls surrounding their sacred temple. Well, that's where I was at. I was inside there walking all around the place. Man. For 6 days, the Romans tried to break through the temple's outer walls with battering rams. Now, those walls are still the same walls that were there before, and those walls were about 4 feet thick of stone, so they'd be a little bit hard to get through. Well, if they'd had a tank, they probably could have got through pretty easy. The Jews determined to save the temple. Now here you go, another bunch of people willing to lose their lives over mists and spooks in the sky. I mean, just like these Muslims over there at Hashish or whatever it was, where they go all this way, thousands and thousands of Muslims, to celebrate supposedly Muhammad gave his last speech on this mountain, which there's absolutely no evidence at all that he did, because then he supposedly went into heaven. You see how people are maneuvered like little kids into believing in spooks in the sky? 700 people died trampling on each other over something that never happened. That's what gets me. It never happened. You know, even the so-called crucifixion of Jesus is fake and phony as hell. And the Jew and the Christians, the new Christian church, blamed the Jews for it. They couldn't have done it because there was no Jesus. Get that through your head. So the Jews is funny. So, you know, it's really funny. The Jews get blamed for something of crucifying a man-God that never was. Anyhow, that pisses off the right-wing conservatives, too. Just like now, they're trying to get, family planning done away with. Looks like my unit has stalled here again. I don't know what the hell is going on. I can tell all those conservative and Zionist Christians I support the ideas of Margaret Sanger. She was a white racist, she was a separatist, and she was a eugenics person trying to improve the race. And if they even improve the black race, I mean, you know. So all these conservative right-wing Zionist Christians are trying to stop the government from operation just over this family planning outfit. For 6 days, the Romans tried to break through the temple's outer walls with battering rams. I don't think they could get through in 10 months. Those walls were something else. In another attack, they scaled the walls with ladders. The Jews, determined to save the temple, fought fiercely and beat back the Romans time and time again. Well, anybody that controlled that walled city of Jerusalem, no matter who they were, had a good chance of holding off anybody. Titus finally ordered soldiers to set fire to the wooden gates leading to the temple, and after the fire had burned almost 2 days, he launched his final attack. As the furious onslaught began, a Roman soldier hurled a burning firebrand through one of the temple's golden windows. A huge fire erupted within, quickly spreading to the wooden beams. Roman soldiers raced wildly into the courts of the temple, killing all who had stood in their way. More fires were set. Desperate Jews fought bravely, but were outnumbered. Poor Jews. Cries of despair rose together from the sounds of the crackling flame in one dreadful roar. As the flames rose higher and the building began to crumble, many devout Jews hurled themselves into the fire, unwilling to live without their sacred temple. Another crazy-ass thing, worshiping spooks in the sky, as Ben Klassen would say. Thousands of others, believing that a miracle would spare them, there you go, stood resolutely in the temple's inner court. The Romans slaughtered some 6,000 of them. What happened? Not Jesus. Their big God Jehovah didn't show up. He never does when they're in trouble. You notice that? They, right to the end, they're praying for their God to show up and save them. He never saves them. Never did, never will. Oh, unless they lie and dream up a story like a lot of the stuff in the Old Testament. The temple was burned to the ground. Well, I don't know how they could do. Well, I guess the temple was made more of wood, but almost everything around that Jerusalem is stone streets, stone walks, stone walls, stone buildings. But the taking of Jerusalem was not yet over. Some rebel leaders escaped the inferno and took up positions in the fortified upper city. After 18 days of preparation, the Romans scaled the walls and took this fortress too. With its final victory, the Romans sacked the city, set it afire, and tore down the walls. Wow. I don't see how they could have torn down those walls. I mean, 4 feet, 4 or 5 feet thick, and, you know, 30, 40 feet high. I don't see how they could have done that. I love those Romans. Boy, when I was over there in Israel, I wasn't interested in all that nonsense that they talked about Judaism and Christianity. Most of the people I were with are a bunch of Christ insanity people. I was interested in all those Roman cities over there. I got to see a lot of Roman stuff, and boy, that impresses you. That impresses you. Well, that was a little long, but you might find it interesting, and also how they slant the story to be nice to the Jews. Let's end up the show here with a little bit of left-wing stuff and see what how you can see how some of us are coming together on this stuff. Yeah, this is a left-winger.
A good part of today is sitting in front of this useless, asinine Senate. You know, I'm so old I can remember when the Senate was the legislative body that did things that were constructive for the American people. That did to use the rest of the world as a capitalist playground. I admit that. I said it before. I've been brainwashed like you have. But occasionally would focus on helping Americans, a common folk, not the corporatist predators. But those days are gone. So, Kerry, going in front of the Senate today about this nuclear deal with Iran, and how it's the only chance to slow that country's nuclear ambitions. And he also pointed out that failure to enact the agreement for the Senate and everybody to enact the agreement in this country would isolate the United States internationally. You know, don't forget, it wasn't just the United States that sat down to negotiate this. There were six countries involved, including Russia and China. Kerry told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and oh my God, who's the head of that? Bob Corker from Tennessee? That's... Oh, well, no point in dwelling on it, Malloy. Anyway, he told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, quote, if the U.S. negotiating this multilateral agreement with five other partners were to walk away from those partners, we're on our own. End quote, John Kerry. But there are people in this country who absolutely want that. There are people in the highest levels of government in this country who absolutely want the United States to disengage from every single agreement. I'm talking about the agreements that are legit, that are there to try to find solutions other than sanctions and war and invasions. There are people in this country in the highest levels of government who want the sanctions and the war and the misery. Us Christians, because, you know, this is a battle working up to Armageddon. There's got to be slaughter. There's got to be death and destruction. I'm serious. That's it. You know, read. Listen to what these crazy and religious nutcases who wind up in the U.S. House and the Senate, read what they're saying. This is what they're saying. Bastards. Bastards. Kerry said that a congressional rejection of what he and the representatives of five other countries worked out, rejection would amount to, his words, a great big green light for Iran to double the pace of its uranium enrichment, proceed full speed ahead with a heavy water reactor, install new and more efficient centrifuges, and do it all without the unprecedented inspection and transparency measures that we have secured, and he meant with this agreement. He added, quote, everything we have prevented would then start taking place, end quote. But that's what the right-wing nutballs in our legislative branch of government wants. And that's step one. They want this agreement to fail. They want Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, to keep shooting off his mouth about how we will always, you know, hate the U.S. Okay, good for you. Hate us. It doesn't make any difference anymore. It really doesn't. You know why the legislative branch of our government wants this? These are the ones who jumped off their asses every time Netanyahu burped or farted when he came over here and addressed a joint session of Congress. Step two is to encourage Israel to unleash nuclear hell in Iran. Oh, that's, listen, if we poor, powerless Americans realized how close that reality is, I think we would all be digging cement-lined holes so that when the trouble begins and the missiles start flying, what the hell. But that American legislators want. They want this thing to go belly up. They want it to die a mourning so that Israel then can launch nuclear strikes against Tehran. Madness? What do you call it?
Well, we had some cutouts there, but I think you got the general idea. Him talking about the Zionists and the crazy Christians and the apocalypse and so forth about the end of the world, man, and it's going to start in the Middle East because Israel's going to start dropping atomic bombs and so forth like that, and the crazy Christian fanatics are going to be pushing it and supporting it. I'm telling you, they're crazy. That's it for today. I'll be back Moonsday and getting back in the groove here from having a whole week of entertaining my visitor, my grandson. We went all over the place, so we tried to do the show and do that and do everything. So we're back now. We'll be back Monday with another shoe. Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581.